Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our monthly Lunch and Leadership Conference call. If you would like a copy of today's slides, send me an email at tom@scarletleadership.com, and I'll send that to you this afternoon. Also, there will be a playback of this call available tomorrow on our website, and I will tweet that out. And during the call, if you have a question, hit *7, or you can, if you're listening and watching online, you can enter it into the box and hit submit. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Joe Scarlett.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome again to one of our Lunch and Learn calls. Today we have with us Whitney Johnson, and I met Whitney quite a few years ago through our friend Marshall Goldsmith, who I think has been on a couple of these calls in the past. And Whitney's written an absolutely fabulous book that I'm just about halfway through reading right now called Disrupt Yourself. And it's really it's a neat book, and it's a neat discussion about how disruption can make such a huge difference in business. But rather than me tell you about that, let me turn it over to Mary Fink. Mary?
Thank you, Joe, and we are glad to have you with us, Whitney. When I was sharing some information with Joe about the call, I was saying to him, you know, her book is Disrupt Yourself. Your book, Joe, should be Disrupt Everybody Around You, because that's sort of what he does. But it is a great read. We are fortunate enough to have an advanced copy, so we are a little bit ahead of the game. But Whitney has done a great job with the book, and she has actually referenced Tractor Supply in the book, and which makes us happy always. But it's really great information, and so I'm going to ask Whitney a few questions and have her tell us a little bit about it, and then you'll have an opportunity to ask questions. As always, as Tom said, you can ask a question in the middle if you have something that's just burning on your mind, or email us and we will ask the question immediately. But I'd like to start out with this one, Whitney. As I read in your introduction, you really disrupted yourself from a very successful career at Merrill Lynch, and I guess that maybe was the inspiration for the book, or maybe the coming book was the inspiration for the change. But tell us a little bit about how you define personal disruption.
Great question. Well, we typically think of this idea of disruptive innovation as a term of art that you hear in the business world very frequently. And it's really the act of employing a practice that's usually used by companies and countries and products by introducing a product that the entire market initially deems inferior. So, for example, Amazon. And then that product ends up upending the market. So just as Amazon upended Borders and Uber is now upending the yellow cabs, they have come in at the low end of the market, they've upended the market, and you take this practice you typically use to apply to companies and countries and apply it to us as individuals and our careers.
So what inspired you to do this? To just upend yourself and go someplace and do something else?
Great question. Well, I think a good place to start to answer that question is whenever you think of buying a product, you're not just buying a product, you're actually hiring it to do a job. And that job you're hiring it to do has both functional and emotional elements. So, for example, when you buy a horse, you may buy a horse because you want to get from point A to point B. But in fact, you probably buy it for the emotional job of it's fun to ride a horse, you're able to get exercise, it feels good to have the wind in your face. And so that's the emotional job that the horse does for you. But whenever you take on a new job inside of a corporation or become an entrepreneur, there's a similar thing happening, where you want it to do a functional job of putting food on your table, but you also want it to do an emotional job of it feel like you're learning and growing and progressing. Well, one of the things that happened for me at Merrill Lynch is I could have continued to stay there as an equity analyst covering stocks, and it could have done the functional job of putting food on the table, but it was no longer doing the emotional job because I had learned as much as I could learn, pretty much. I was probably getting paid as much as I could get paid. And so when there wasn't an opportunity for me to have these emotional and sort of psychic benefits of my work, even though it could do the functional job, I felt the need to disrupt myself and try something new.
Excellent. There's a quote in your introduction that says it's not really about coping with the force of disruption, but harnessing its power and unpredictability and learning to ride its waves and to disrupt yourself. So it's really about the rush, isn't it? If you think
about it. It really is. I think that's a great way to describe it. I mean, I think, you know, we look at the world around us, and I do think that things are changing ever faster, and that's in part because technology really makes that possible. And so some of us can look at that and say, oh, this is sort of scary. There are so many things that are happening, and they're happening so quickly. But instead of being scared by it, to say, you know, let me enjoy the rush of it. And, you know, since you introduced that idea, let's think about waves in an ocean, right? If you think about the waves on an ocean, you can sort of have the experience of just being in the ocean and being tumbled by those waves, which most of us have that experience as a child if we've gone to the ocean. But what if you could instead learn how to surf and have that experience of going out into the ocean and getting on a surfboard and riding those waves, and then when one crashes, getting on another one, and so you're not coping with the force of those waves, but you're in fact riding those waves and having, like you said, that exhilaration of exercising and enjoying that.
It's keeping the excitement going always.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Joe, I think you have some things to add here.
Well, when we look at the Tractor Supply history, we disrupted ourselves back in the early 1980s when we just took an entirely different approach to the business. There were 40-some-odd chains of stores like us in those days, and everybody was doing roughly the same kinds of things in, you know, different ways, but the same general emphasis on taking care of America's farmers, which were an ever-declining number of businesses, by the way. And we studied our business inside and out, both stores and in the reports, and we realized there's this other customer out there called a hobby farmer, and we just simply shifted our business away from farming to hobby farmers, which was a difficult switch for a lot of our employees because a lot of them were farmers and grew up in that area, but it changed everything about our business. Instead of putting small stores in towns in Iowa, we were putting stores in the outlying suburbs around big cities all over the country. It changed what hours we were open. We opened every store on Sunday. We're open at night till, instead of closing at 5, we closed at 7 or 8 or 9. It changed who we hired. Instead of a bunch of grubby old farmers in the store, we were hiring different kinds of people. They had to be mechanically competent, but we hired people that fit the profile of the customer. We hired our customers. It changed what we carried. It changed how we advertised. We used to carry a lot of farm parts, and they weren't selling, but we saw other things were selling, like equine products, like pet products, like riding lawnmowers and work clothing and truck toolboxes and welders and all these things that relate to the rural lifestyle but don't necessarily relate to production agriculture. We turned the place upside down, and we went in an entirely different direction when none of our competitors did, and today Tractor Supply has three times more stores than the next five competitors put together. We just disrupted ourselves by going down an entirely different path with an entirely different customer, and it changed the dynamics of virtually everything we did.
One of the things, Joe, I like about that story so much, and as Mary said, I've included it in the book, is as you said, you know, there was a moment where it was really difficult for your employees and probably even, you know, you as the shareholders to say, you know what, we're going to completely change how we're doing business. And in that moment, there was a real risk there. I mean, so every time you do disrupt yourself, there is this element of not knowing what will come next. And I think part of the reason I love that story is that you were willing to do that.
It was interesting. We had a lot of mostly young fellows who had grown up as, you know, the second or third son of a farmer, and instead of taking over the family farm from their father, they wound up working for us. And the idea that we would be selling pet food as opposed to cattle fencing, you know, they just sort of, a lot of them had a hard time dealing with it. And some of them just wound up leaving the company, and a few of them we had to let go. But most people came around and as we grew, and the growth didn't start right away, but once it started growing, it really took off. That whole topic went away. But it was a difficult adjustment for a lot of people when we first got started.
So did your leadership group at any point ever feel like ooh, maybe this was a mistake, or did you just march forward once you made the decision without looking back?
Senior levels, there was I can't recall anybody fighting against what we were trying to do. In retailing, it's so easy because you just show people the numbers. You know, we added more pet food. Are we selling more pet food? Yes. Here are the numbers. We sold 10,000 bags of this. And if anybody with an IQ above a tree stump can understand that stuff pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was really hard to argue with the numbers, wasn't it?
And in retailing, you have numbers that are easy to get to. So that makes selling the idea much easier than it is in a process where it might take longer to achieve success.
Exactly. So, Whitney, this is a nice segue into the S-curve because you talk about in the book, you know, you have that hard climb and then you finally get to a place where you've got some momentum going. So tell us what the S-curve is and how it can help companies and individuals understand personal disruption. Tell it to us like you were explaining it to a 10-year-old.
Okay.
Or my mother.
Right? Yeah, okay. So the S-curve, just picture an S in your mind and also picture the wave that we talked about a minute ago. So the S-curve was developed in 1962 by E.M. Rogers to help people understand how ideas spread or, you know, to take hold. And it's frequently now been used to help people understand how quickly an innovation will be adopted. So what it does is it explains to you that at the low end of the S, and again, picture that in your mind, it looks like it's pretty flat. Well, what's happening during that time is that you're trying a lot of different things and you're testing things out, and it will look like you're not making much progress, but in fact, you're gaining momentum so that around 10 or 15% of your way through the project, you just shoot up the back of that S-curve. So think about going up the top of the wave. And at that point, you're moving really quickly. You're in hypergrowth. Everything's working really well. And then you get to the top of the curve, and you're typically around 90% or saturation, and then growth tapers off. And the reason that this S-curve is so helpful when you're trying to disrupt is because there are time delays. There are time delays when you learn. You can work really hard. Nothing seems to be happening. You can be doing very little, and a lot seems to be happening. And that helps you deal with the time delays because most of us like a world where you just flip a switch and the light goes on. Well, we know when it comes to learning, we know when it comes to disruption, you can't flip a switch and the light goes on. You may flip a switch and wait for 30 seconds or 6 months or 2 years. And so the S-curve really helps you understand that that's going to happen. And if you know the growth is slow at the beginning, you don't get as discouraged. If you know that the growth is going really quickly and you're feeling confident, that's where you want to be. And then you also know that at the top of the curve, when you've really figured out what you're doing, you know that you might get bored. And if you don't jump to a new curve like you did with Tractor Supply, or you needed to jump to a new curve, I should say, like you did with Tractor Supply and like I did when I was at Wall Street and I was bored, your plateau seemingly comfortable becomes a precipice. And so the S-curve helps understand and deal with those time delays involved with learning and really recognizing that if you flip a switch, it may not go on immediately, but it helps you provide milestones to watch for while you're waiting for that switch to flip on.
And it may help you know when it's time to launch to another S-curve, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, if you've been at something for a while, and I think, you know, again, going back to Tractor Supply, you had a period of history where you were growing very, very, very quickly and things were working well. And then you got to the top of that curve and you had to say, well, do we want to continue to ride this out and have our margins expand, or are we going to get disrupted from below? And some people just get disrupted from below and others make those hard decisions and decide to try something new. So for you as an individual, if you've been doing something for 4 to 5 years and you're just on automatic and it seems really easy and you start to feel kind of bored, it may mean that it's time for you to find something new to try to do. You don't necessarily have to change companies. You may just need a new role inside of a company, but it is important for you to take on some type of new role.
Should we assume then from the S-curve that if things are not going well, it's just a time thing, or when we're in the lower production or the lower success or the lower learning curve, are we still tweaking and changing, or do we just keep doing what we're doing and wait?
That's a really great question, Mary. Because at the low end, when you're trying to do something new, just think about a new job. You know, you come home every day and you think, oh, I'm terrible at this, but I take on the right job, right? So at the very beginning, you've got a lot of different ideas and tasks and people all coming at you. And so one of the things you don't know is, are you just at the low end of the curve like you just intimated, or are you in fact on the wrong curve? And so what I would say, a good test for you to figure out if you're on the wrong curve or just at the low end, is to think about what you do uniquely well. As you're trying to be on this curve and to make something happening, are you pairing that with what you do uniquely well? And I'll give you an example. A few years ago, my husband and I saw this opportunity as entrepreneurs, that there were kind of in the photography space, there was an opportunity for books, kind of like Shutterfly. Fantastic idea. The problem was is that we were never going to be able to move up that curve because neither of us are photographers. So one of the things that we were going to have to hire the photographers to do it. So one of the things you can do when you're trying to figure out if you're on the right curve and it's just early, or if you're on the wrong curve, is are you able and are you using what you do uniquely well and applying it to that problem? And if you are, then it's a matter of patience. If you're not, you probably want to tweak it and find a different curve or a different business.
Great advice. So, can you tell us a little bit more about the seven variables that can help speed your progress along? We have those on a slide for those of you joining us online, and so I think if you could tell us a little bit about that, about each one of them, it would be helpful for us to maybe avoid some of the pitfalls that
we might find
along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I actually just alluded to a couple of them, but let me just walk through them in order. So the first one is to take the right kinds of risks. And what I mean by that is that there's competitive risk and there's market risk, or at least those are two kinds of risks. And so competitive risk is when you look at a situation and you say, okay, I know there are customers there's a huge opportunity, but I've got projections, I've gone on the internet, I know exactly how big the market is. Well, probably means there's already a kingpin, it's not you, someone else has scoped it out. So you have to gauge if you can compete and win. The other type of risk is market risk, which is you think there's a job that people want done, which is, again, what Tractor Supply did when it pivoted, but you don't know if there's a market for sure. There's some data that tells you there is, but you don't know for sure. Well, that's what you call market risk, because you don't know if there are customers, but if there are customers, you're much more likely to own the market. And so that's one of the first things you want to do when you're thinking about a curve to jump to, whether it's as an entrepreneur, whether it's as a new business line or in your career, is you want to think about ways to create something new, take on market versus competitive risk. And when you do, the disruption theory tells you that the odds of success are 6 times higher and the revenue opportunity 20 times greater. So that's step number one. Go ahead, please.
No, I was just saying, wow, that's a lot. That's a huge
It's huge, you know, isn't it?
It is.
Mary, let me jump in here for a second. You know what, in taking these risks and deciding what you're going to do, the closer you are to the potential customer, the more engaged you can get and focus on the customer and listen to the customer and find out how many customers there are, the better the decision you make about what risk you're going to take.
Running our
company, the closer we are to our customer, the easier it is to decide what products will really work and what products won't work. And the same things, if you're starting something new or going into something new, the better you understand the final user of your product or service, the more likely you are to make a sound decision.
Yeah, that's great. And I love, again, this idea, you know, where you were talking about the data, because that was giving you a lot of information about the customer. And I'll actually touch on that. You just gave me an idea. I'll touch a little bit more on that in a second when I get to the third variable. The second one I've actually spoken about is this idea of strength. So figuring out not only what you do well, but what you do uniquely well. So, for example, you might be very, very good at cooking, But if you're in a room of 20 people that cook well, that's not so exciting. But if you are a really good cook in a room of 19 people that can't cook and you need to put on a banquet, you've now got a distinctive strength and you're going to be able to move up a curve much more quickly, especially because you've now paired that strength with a need, which is you need a banquet. The third one is embracing constraints. And I think, Joe, you said something really important, because whenever you're trying something new, you're always going to be short on something. You may not have enough time. You may not have enough expertise. You may not have enough money. And most of us tend to think, oh, if only I had, then I would be able to make this happen. But the reality is, and the research says, that whenever you try something new, you actually need a lot of feedback. You need it quickly, and the best way to get that is to impose constraints. And so when Joe said you need to get close to the customer, what happens is when you don't have very much money, you don't have the luxury of spending a lot to figure out if they're going to be customers. You've got to figure out if they're customers and fast. And so that requires you to go to the customer so that you can get profits more quickly. And so I think it's a really important, getting close to the customer is one of the best ways you can figure out if you're on the right curve. Number four is a willingness to battle entitlement. I think that entitlement comes in many, many guises. But again, this idea of, as we talked about a minute ago, is whenever you're trying to get something new done, you have to battle this entitlement that you feel of, I've got a good idea, therefore people should just buy into it. One of the most important things you can do to get your ideas to move forward, whether you're an entrepreneur or not, is to be willing to do the hard work of explaining your ideas in a way that other people can understand. And so, again, this idea of the data, when you changed over your store format and you have these store people who've been there for generations, when you show them the data, most of them said, oh, I get it. That was using the data to get buy-in so that you can move more quickly up the curve and retain this talent. Number five is taking a step back to grow. We talked about that Tractor Supply casebook example of that. Number six is giving failure its due, understanding that failure is part of this process of disruption, and acknowledging it, respecting it, grieving it when it happens, and then moving on. And then number seven is being driven by discovery, having a willingness to be curious, to tolerate ambiguity, knowing that 70% of all successful businesses end up with a strategy different than the one they pursued, and it will also be true for us. And so if we can understand that our curiosity will hold us in good stead, we'll be able to move up our curves more quickly. So those are the seven basic steps that you need to move up your learning curve quickly and as painlessly as possible.
And there's much information about each of those in the book, so that is explained in great detail.
A couple of thoughts, Mary,
that
Whitney had just mentioned here. The subject of curiosity, I find that in order to get any breakthrough idea or breakthrough process going, you've really got to be very curious. You've got to be asking the questions and continually pushing the envelope and looking in areas that you wouldn't normally look in. And some people are naturally curious, and those are the folks that are much more likely to disrupt things than those who are not curious. So I think that's a very important part of the process. And additionally, we were talking earlier about, I'm not sure you used this term exactly, but selling your idea. That's a big part of the process when you're trying to do something new and different. Selling that idea sometimes is very difficult, and your ability as a salesman to your constituents can make all the difference in the world. Sometimes great ideas exist in people's minds, but they can't express them, in which case they generally lay fallow. But the ability to sell that idea can get other people on your bandwagon. It can help get momentum going for you.
Yeah, exactly. And oftentimes it involves a translation of your ideas, right, to not necessarily a different language, but to, from math to marketing or from marketing to coding or something like that. So, it's huge, but it is fun to do.
I find a lot of entrepreneurs have difficulty expressing their ideas in terms that others can understand. They tend to deal in technical terms and often in buzzwords that nobody understands, and that's a big obstacle for entrepreneurs who are trying to start something new.
Yeah.
I think you're right. And that because it's in my head and not anywhere else, it's even more important that I be able to explain it well and let people know what the benefit is going to be. But this whole idea, I think of all of the variables, the one that struck me was the battle, the entitlement. Just because I think it's a great idea and I think you should have it, you know, I shouldn't get upset when you don't buy it immediately or you don't accept it or you're not wide open to it. I haven't thought about it that way before.
I've seen salesmen come and try to sell us products, and they have what could be a really neat product, but they don't know how to explain it in terms. I shouldn't say salesmen, more likely engineers trying to sell their products, and they're not able to express themselves in the terms that a business person and a consumer can understand.
Yeah. Mary, building on what you said and what Joe said, for me, this is probably one of the most interesting chapters to write because we tend to say, oh, you know, millennials, they're so entitled, you know, like, oh, I'm so glad you brought this up. And yet, as we think about it and we really peel it back, we realize that all of us struggle with entitlement. It comes in lots of different guises, and being willing to get buy-in for our ideas is just one of the ways that we can battle it. And if we're willing to do it, it allows us, you know, to move up this curve really quickly and perhaps, you know, equally important, not slide back down the curve as you start to see some success. So I love to hear that one really resonated with you.
Definitely it did. What advice would you give leaders who are considering disrupting things in their company or their department or their area of responsibility in terms of applying some of this?
Great question. I think that one of the pieces of research that I came across as I was working on this is that high-performing companies, ones that really surpass their peers on nearly every metric, are the ones who develop capabilities before they need them. And what that sounds like really easy and like a great idea, but what that means is that as a leader, as a person running a business or any type of organization, right at the moment when you're seeing revenue, you know, the rate of revenue increasing, perhaps, and your margins expanding, when things are feeling really good and you're sort of fist bumping all around the office, right at that very time is the time where you need to be thinking about taking a step back in order to grow, which means that maybe that some of your talents internally, you need to realign them. You may need to take that hit to short-term productivity in order to gear up to climb the next curve and to be able to retain that talent, and maybe you're going to even need different talent for the next curve. And so I think for me, one of the most important things I would think as a leader is to say to yourself, okay, if I want to be prepared to jump to the next curve, I may need to disrupt my short-term productivity to prepare my team so that I have the talent in place to scale the next curve when it is time to jump.
Excellent, and that keeps everyone engaged and excited about what's going on in the company as well.
Right, absolutely. I mean, if you're, you know, going back to this S-curve, when you're on that sweet, steep back in that period of hypergrowth, you're feeling very competent, you're feeling very confident, and the other thing that's happening is you don't know everything yet, but you know enough to be productive, and your brain is firing on all cylinders, your synapses, you've got a lot of endorphins going, and that's where you want your people to be because they're excited to be at work and they're really productive when they're in that place.
Right. I would think it would be much more exciting to be there than to be in a place where I think I know everything.
Right. Exactly.
But when you think you know everything, you're not open to new thoughts. So.
Yeah. That's the irony, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, So I've got all these people that are really excited, and now I've moved them into a new place, and so they're excited about that. But how do I deal with the naysayers?
Hmm. great question. So I think one of the things that happens is that whenever you disrupt yourself, and this is why I say this idea of taking a step back in order to grow, it's not just taking a step back, but you will almost always have someone look at you and think you are cuckoo bananas. They wonder why on earth you would walk away from stature or financial security to try something new. And so if you can understand that that is bound to happen when you disrupt yourself, but you understand that the net present value of these decisions you're making could potentially lead to a slingshot forward, it allows you to pull back and have the perspective that you need to understand that this decision actually is going to allow you to intersect with where you want to go. And so you deal with the naysayers by taking a step back and having a sort of longer-term perspective.
Okay. Joe, any comments?
No, not right at this point. I thought we were going to get some questions then, but go ahead.
Okay. Before we go to questions, and again, we can take questions anytime, Whitney, tell me anything else that you would like us to know or anything else that you would like us to consider, any other things that we need to explore or perhaps give some serious thought to before we might want to make this change or make this disruption? Is there counsel that we need to talk about a lot of people, or is it better to just go out and jump in ourselves and do it?
Well, it's good to jump in. I think what I would say is when you're making the decision to jump to a new curve, and again, it can be, you know, different kinds of curves, whether it's career or personal or, you know, starting a business or changing jobs, is to think about the fact that when you're making that jump, it's going to be scary, and sometimes you're going to feel lonely. And so one of the things that's really important to do is recognize that it's important to have dreams about things, you know, that you want to accomplish, sort of a grander objective, because it's the dream that allows you to pack the parachute you need to have a safer and less terrifying jump from one curve to the next. And so I think that would be the first thing I would say is if it's scary and lonely, you're probably on the right path to disruption because that's what you do. You're playing where other people aren't playing. To number two, pack your parachute with a dream, because dreaming really is the engine of disruption. And the third I would say is when you get to that new curve, be patient with yourself. Just like a new job, it takes 6 months to gear up. When you're at the low end of the curve, you're going to work really hard, and it doesn't look like anything's happening. But, in fact, you're building up momentum that's going to allow you to move into hypergrowth. So just be patient, hang in there, and you will eventually start to see the fruits of your efforts.
Whitney, a couple of other thoughts to that. I think as you develop your dream, we talked earlier about being able to communicate the dream, which is very important. I would also, for those folks who are married and have families, it's very important to get the support of your family and your spouse and whoever's close to you in the process too, so they're on board with helping you achieve the dream. Sometimes a little bit of help from family or spouse can make all the difference in the world.
That is huge. And when we're talking about buy-in, probably the most important buy-in is from your loved ones. You know, in the dedicatory portion of my book, I said it's to my husband who always says jump. And the fact is that without him, and we all need a person, you know, like that in our life who we can get buy-in from and who will give it to us, we really need to surround ourselves with someone like that. I'm so glad you said that, Jill.
There's no substitute for having support for something, no matter where it comes from, and especially from those that are closest to. I have an online question for you, Whitney, and that is, how long was it between you making your decision and actually making the change, and then making the change and then feeling like you had done the right thing? Was it a long period?
I love it. That's a great
question.
Tell
us your story. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what a great question. So So from the time, so it was 2005, so about a decade ago. As I said earlier, I was on Wall Street. I was at the top of my game. I probably had about 6 months where I was thinking about it, and but when I finally made the decision to do it, it was probably about 2 months. I will tell you, in all honesty, I think I was a little bit foolhardy. So I, you know, in a perfect world, I would have thought through that a little bit more carefully and probably planned longer. And again, I say in a perfect world because maybe I wouldn't have screwed up the courage to jump if I had thought about it too much. But I would say it was probably about two months. Again, if you can deal with that sort of tension of staying and not jumping to prepare to jump, that's ideal. But sometimes the ideal doesn't happen. So that was about 2 months. Now, to answer your second question, how long did it take before I felt like I was gaining some traction? I would say I had a good 6 months, if not probably closer to a year. Part of me was decompressing, and our children were still young, where I was trying lots and lots and lots of ideas. I had written a children's book, which didn't get published. I had an idea for a television show, a reality TV show about soccer in Latin America, which didn't happen. So I was iterating. Some things worked, some things did not. But before, by the time I sort of started to lock and load, into something new, which is when I co-founded the investment firm of Clayton Christensen, it was probably about a year and a half. So I mapped pretty closely to this S curve and, you know, the 10,000 hours. So that's why I say you've got to be patient, because you're just not going to know immediately. And like I said, that 70% rule, you're going to iterate, and eventually you'll figure it out, but you probably won't. You know, the first person you date is not usually the person you marry, in very rare instances.
Exactly. Great answer. Anything else that you want us to know?
No, I think the things I said a moment ago about having the dream and understanding if you're scared, then you're probably on the right path. And in fact, you know, actually, you just gave me one other thing I do want to say. Is that if you know inside of yourself that you do need to try something new and you don't, you're going to die inside a little, because I think the human spirit wants to progress. We want to move forward. We want to move from stuck to unstuck. And so if you have that feeling that you need to do it, then you've got to listen to it and make plans to be able to jump. So I think that would be the other thing I would say that's really important. And it's hard, of course, because you're going to lose something, but that's why they call it the innovator's dilemma. Because whether you jump to a curve or not, you're going to have to take on some type of risk.
That's true. And we hear so much today about innovation. And in a lot of companies, I think innovation is the idea behind it is sort of incrementally moving from one step to the next logical step, as opposed to total disruption and something that is brand new.
Right. I mean, because that's a lot easier to do, right? The incremental piece is a lot easier to do. But, you know, typically if you're, you know, in a place where you're really robust and you want to get to the next level, you're going to have to do some sort of self-disruption. And again, my whole thesis is that the best way to drive corporate innovation is to think about personal disruption, because that's going to really give you the momentum you need to get your people in a place where they're able to come up with the ideas for those wholesale disruptions and to actually execute and implement them.
Right. You have a quote in another quote that I wrote down, and that is, self-disruption will force you up steep hills of new information, relationships, and systems. It may seem insurmountable, but the S-curve helps understand if we keep working, we can reach the point where understanding and competence will shoot upward. And I think the important, to me, what jumped out at me from that quote was that it wasn't just new information or a new idea, it's new relationships. It's working with people that I may not have even known before. It's making new contacts and finding those people that can help me with my idea, and systems as well. I mean, I think a lot of times we just think it's going to happen, but we have to give some thought to how it's going to happen.
Well, I love that narrative. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I wrote that, but I hadn't focused as much on the relationship piece, but you're absolutely right. I love that you highlighted that.
Yeah, very important. I know that when we have our own story with the Scarlet Leadership Institute, and Joe jump in any time, but we were hoping to provide something that wasn't already out there. And so for that reason, instead of just deciding that we knew best what people needed, we went to, Joe contacted a number of people in our area that were CEOs of companies as large as the largest in our town to some smaller construction companies. And we had hours and hours of conversation, two and three people at a time, about leadership and about what was needed and about what wasn't being provided already. And I think that was the piece that had people buy into what we were doing because they had helped us design it. And that's part of that relationship thing that I was alluding to.
What was it? Do you remember what the single biggest thing was? What the single biggest hole people said was? Do you guys remember?
I know it's been a while. What they said was, and it was very consistent across the board, it was, it's all about the people skills. It's not about finance or strategy or the business school, quote unquote, courses. It's all, what distinguishes, and what we're hearing more and more and reading more about these days, is the emotional intelligence. It's the understanding not only myself, but understanding other people and how to respond to that and how to work with them as people.
Mary, I remember two specifics of that were very, very focused. A lot of the CEOs told us that they're bringing these folks along and they need to be able to stand up in front of a group and deliver effectively. And the matter is, so many of these young folks don't get to that point or get there in a very clumsy way. And the other, and probably even a stronger point, is that they would say, I have these bright folks coming up who are reluctant to deal with personnel issues, reluctant to deal with problems, and our senior leaders need to be able to get in and dive into a situation and don't avoid it, particularly personnel issues.
Interesting. So the first one was their ability to communicate their ideas, which has been an interesting sort of ongoing thread in our conversation today. But then you're saying the second one was an ability to skirmish, but not in a bad way, but to sort of deal with friction and problem solve together. That's interesting that they found that people were struggling with that so much. Huh.
Well, and to be able to have a civil disagreement, to be able to have a conversation about something where we disagree, but have it not be, you know, relationship ending, if you will.
Right. It goes back, I guess we keep coming back to this idea of entitlement, of kind of a willingness to communicate your ideas. And then also one of the things I thought was really interesting is a book by Mary Pfeiffer. You may remember she wrote Reviving Ophelia, and she talks about pronouns and really observing the pronouns that we use. And whenever you think of innovation, it's really easy to frame it as a battle, you know, disruptor versus disrupted and David versus Goliath. But when you're trying to move an idea in an organization and oftentimes that's where the conflict arises, is that it's important to not think of it as David versus Goliath, because David and Goliath are actually on the same side of the table. And so how do you shift your pronouns, because they indicate our choices and how we think, from you and me and us and them to we, and figure out a way to have a conversation where you're using the words we, and that starts to shift your ability to resolve those conflicts, in my view.
Exactly. And that brings us full circle back to where you talk about it forces you up the steep hills of new relationships. I mean, it's not always easy, and it's not always the same people that we've been talking to before.
Yeah, exactly. Or certainly talking to them differently, you know, either new people or talking differently. Huh.
Exactly. Great. Well, we'd like to open it up to questions now. If you are on the phone, *7. If you are online, write your question in the box and hit submit. What questions do you have? Joe, what question do you have?
What question do
Give
I have?
Give me a hard one. Give me a hard one.
I have a promotional question. I didn't realize that the book was not yet published. I thought it was, and we just got a paper a email copy because that was the easiest way to get it to us. So why don't you, Whitney, tell us a little bit about when the book's coming out and how I can buy one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you for asking that question. So it will be released on October 6th. You can pre-order it now on, you know, anywhere, Amazon, any of your independent bookstores, and whether hardcover or Kindle, and it will be out in Audible, I think, in another month or so. So that's the best way to find it, and if you want more information, you can obviously just go to my website at whitneyjohnson.com or follow me on Twitter at JohnsonWhitney. So yeah, 2 weeks and I guess less than 2 weeks now before it comes out.
Very exciting.
The name of the book is Disrupt Yourself.
Yes, Putting the Power of Disruptive Innovation to Work.
And the sequel will be from me called Disrupt Everybody.
Exactly. I will look forward to that.
We live that every day.
Okay.
You're already writing the sequel. Good. You've got lots
there
of
There you
material.
Go. Anyone
well, folks,
questions?
Opportunity to ask questions. First question gets a prize. You got 3 seconds.
Ooh.
3, 2, 1. Nope, no question.
First question gets a book.
There you go.
And I will have some books shortly.
Well, Whitney, we want to thank you very much for joining us. I'm looking forward to finishing the book myself, and I think you got it's a wonderful topic, I have a feeling you're going to be very successful with it. And everybody's on this call, you better go out and buy one. And additionally, the folks that are on the call, our next call will be on Thursday, October 15th, with a speaker yet to be announced. We've got a couple in the hopper, and we haven't confirmed either one of them yet. So we'll see you all next.
Just a minute. Hold on, Joe. We do have one online. I just got it. Whitney, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. So they get a book. Awesome.
Okay. What does ideal top-down innovation look like? For example, how much involvement by leadership or autonomy, and what do you think is the most important?
Oh, that's a great question. So I would say that for innovation to happen, several things need to happen. So obviously, you need to have a leader at the top of the organization who is encouraging it and encouraging ideas and people and is willing to listen to ideas of people more junior to them or outside of the organization. So the leader really does model that. And they certainly create an environment where the junior people in the organization are open to and providing their ideas. The actual really critical component to innovation inside of an organization is not so much the CEO or even the people who are relatively junior, but it's middle management. And the reason that middle management is so critical is that if you think about this S curve, at the low end of the curve, you know, you don't have much to lose. You're starting of your career. If it doesn't work, you'll go somewhere else. If you're at the top, you've got a fair amount of latitude, and sort of the sky's the limit if you work. If it works. But in your middle, if you think about middle management, there's a lot to lose, and there may not be a lot of upside to espousing and encouraging new ideas. So it absolutely needs to come from the top. You'll have ideas bubble up from the bottom, but one of the key things that the CEO can do is make it possible for middle management in the form of how they're compensated and the metrics that they're measured by to actually encourage those innovative ideas in a way that makes it not quite so risky for them to do so.
That's great, because that is middle management is so key in any kind of change, and is often left out in terms of bringing them along at the proper time. So that is great advice.
I think it's important that the senior leadership be talking about the importance of innovation and being open to new ideas. When somebody comes with a new idea, our continuous response always ought to be thank you for your ideas, and we ought to encourage new ideas to pop up. And And I think you're right. The best ideas probably come out of the middle management ranks. When I talk to a group, I'd always say, you know, if the competitors are all going east, we need to consider going west, because by doing something different may give us some competitive advantage.
There you go.
Hence you're disrupting everybody else, because that's how you're thinking.
Right.
And there you go. We have another online question. Should a company only work on one S-curve at a time? What happens when multiple departments within a company are working on different S-curves?
Oh, great. That's a great question. I think that you want different departments to be working on different S-curves. I mean, because they see things from a different vantage point. There's obviously, you know, how you end up allocating resources, which is why, again, sort of middle management, sort of senior middle management matters. In terms of those different departments getting their ideas socialized and adopted, I think this goes back to battling entitlement. It's really important that you have marketing people having lunch with technical people, and so that there is this cross-fertilization taking place. As you are climbing your separate S-curves, you're socializing them with each other, you're learning from each other, and again, management is then compensating you not only for what's coming out of your department, but also for your willingness to collaborate across silos and across departments.
Thank you. I have a third question. Actually, it's a quote. Innovative disruption is disturbing when it's done to me. Innovative disruption is exhilarating when I'm part of doing it. And it's a quote from a board meeting that someone had yesterday. So I guess it depends on which side of the S-curve you're on.
That's exactly right. I mean, I would say it slightly differently, but I love how you said it. I love the rawness of how you said it, that we all want to be the agents of disruption, but none of us want to be the subject.
Right.
You know, it's part of life, and so I think that it's something, this idea of emotional intelligence, to understand that sometimes we are going to be disrupting someone else, or someone else gets disrupted out of a job, and to recognize what it feels like. Sometimes we jump off a curve, sometimes we're pushed off a curve. And so if we're willing to recognize that it may be us today, if not tomorrow, that when there is some empathy involved, if you do need to push someone off a curve, to do it kindly and help them pack the parachute so that they have their sense of self and their self-worth intact as they jump to that new curve.
That's great advice. And I think it also emphasizes or highlights the need to stay in touch with people every step of the way, because, so that it's not a done deal and all of a sudden I'm pushing you off the curve and it's the first you've heard of it. So communication, you know, all the change information that we have, telling you everything that I know as I know it, not when I'm ready to announce it as a big announcement.
Right. Agreed.
All right. Any more questions? These have been great questions.
Yes. Thank you, everyone, for being real. I mean, I really appreciate it. I loved your thoughtful, insightful questions, so thank you.
Thank you, Whitney. Joe, I'll let you close us out.
Well, Mary, thanks for everything. Tom, thanks for keeping us on track technically. And Whitney, it's great to talk to you again. I'm really enthusiastic about your book, and I know it's going to be a wild success, and I thank you very much for joining us. And we'll see you all next month, October 15th on a Thursday. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.